This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to TV Good, Sleep Bad, the podcast that spends way too much time watching television and doing random things instead of sleeping or its job or schoolwork or whatever it is that we should be doing. I am your host, Daniel Lackey. I am joined, as always, by the ever-chipper Elwood Jones. How you doing, Elwood?
I'm good, as always, Mr. Lackey.
That's good to hear. This is our fourth Spectacular Ganda episode, and yep. We are going to be taking a look at two rather disparate pieces of entertainment that nonetheless both involve, in some way or form, somebody named Xander.
That's probably the most tedious link we've done for a show yet, I think.
Well, hey, you know, you take what you can get. First of all, we're going to be looking at an early episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer entitled I, Robot, You, Jane. And then the entire first season, although that isn't saying much, you can watch it all in about 90 minutes, of the Canadian two-hander, The Booth at the End. And where do we want to go from here?
I think let's start with what we've been watching. I mean, what's been holding your attention this week?
Well, what has been holding my attention this week? Well, Doctor Who is going. That is always a thing in the background at this time of year.
That's still on.
Yeah, it's still on. hasn't been canceled yet. Moffat thinks it can run for another 5 years. So
okay.
So there you go. It's been any season of Doctor Who is a ride, and we've had some good episodes and we've had some not so good episodes. Had a couple good episodes with Maisie Williams, Arya from Game of Thrones. A not so good episode coming recently, unfortunately, starring one of my favorite British comic actors, Rhys Shearsmith of the League of Gentlemen. But for the most part, it's been pretty good. The other things that have been capturing my attention lately have been Fargo.
Okay.
Which is in its second season right now.
Yeah.
As expected, this one flashes back to 1979 and the gang war. In as much as you can call a bunch of Midwesterners gangs.
Yeah. I mean, I've not watched season two yet. I had like the first four episodes taped, and then it was sort of weighing it up against everything else I had to watch, and you know, I needed the space to record Shipping Wars. So I'm probably going to wait until it comes on Netflix. But how's this weighing up so far against season one, which I kind of enjoyed? I don't think I enjoyed it as much as everyone else seemed to, but I enjoyed it for the most part.
I'm really enjoying it. I know some people have said that they feel it's a bit of a slow burn compared to the first season, which I thought the first season was a bit of a slow burn as well. But I think it's fantastic. It's easily one of my favorite shows right now, and it's got some absolutely brilliant performances. Again, as with the first season, by people that you might not necessarily. You know, people who, you know, actors who stretch out a little bit, particularly Brad Garrett from Everybody Loves Raymond did an absolutely chilling turn as a Kansas City crime lord, and a lot of other good performances from Patrick Wilson, Bokeem Woodbine, Gene Smart. It's just fabulous all around. It's been a real treat to watch.
Okay. I was weighing it up against everything else I had to watch, and I think this is the problem. We're now in that time of year where every show is either coming back or we've got new shows starting. It's really getting sort of about weighing up the options of, am I going to stick with this? Have I got time to work it in? And so, unfortunately, Fargo fell by the way. American Horror Story Season 5, Hotel. Again, also got recorded and deleted without me even watching a single one. But to be honest, after I watching Scream Queens, I tapped out of that after two episodes. So I really am not too fussed about anything Ryan Murphy's attached to. So, but Fargo, I will eventually get around to watching.
I gave up on American Horror Story after the third season. They really lost me with the Coven season.
Yeah.
It was... The first two seasons, I think, they were generally entertaining, but they were very uneven. In both cases, they had just completely out there endings. And it was just really clear that I don't think either him or Brad Falchuk really knew, had like a path they were going on. But just things just seemed so bizarre on the Coven season that I just couldn't bother with the Freak Show season after that.
I always get the feeling that he's telling a story which we could get told comfortably in 6 episodes, yet he's aiming for 12.
Right.
So you get to the halfway point, and this has happened, I think, I would say every season of the show. Each season I'm sort of drawn back in by the prospect of something exciting happening, and I get to about episode 6, I'm like, I'm bored.
Yeah.
This isn't going anywhere, and again, with the Freak Show season, that was more that I felt were basically just ripping off Freaks.
Right.
Know, if I want to watch Sideshow done well, I just watch Todd Browning's Freaks instead.
Yeah.
Which is just like a masterpiece. And Murphy was just basically giving us a dollar bin version of it. So.
Right. And then the other thing that's been I've been watching a few episodes here and there of Archer.
Okay.
Do you like it? I like Archer, yeah. I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite shows, but it's something I can kind of comfortably kind of like zone out to that I'll remember the dialogue from. And it's got good performances and good dialogue. I do like the style. I do like the performances. And then obviously to go along with what we did a couple episodes ago with Bob and David, the new Netflix sketch comedy, with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross. Which we discussed a little bit before starting recording.
We did. Yeah, it's already given, as I said already, mentioned before we came on, it's given me one of my favorite images of the year, which is basically the Pope on a quad giving the finger while advertising, I don't know, a laxative or...
It's. I think it was like an acid reflux medication is what I was kind of reading it as.
But it's... Just as a layman, sort of, because I've only seen a few episodes of Mr. Show, but I enjoyed the first episode of Bob and David. I mean, you as the established fan, though, I mean, how does it weigh up?
It holds up very well. It holds up very well against the original show. I think having the original, a lot of the original cast, a lot of the original writers helps. It's got a team that's got a good rhythm, you know. With each other, and having that very brief season format, that it's only 4 episodes, and a making of, I think obviously with David Cross and Odenkirk, you know, tied up in other projects, it's probably about the best they could do with their schedule. But I think really having that shortened, you know, amount there, I think really kind of tightens up the pace and keeps a lot of the deadwood off the screen. But I really think it holds up very well in the, particularly the rapport between a lot of the core actors really still holds up. And the first episode's probably my favorite as well. My favorite being the no nonsense judge being replaced by the nonsense judge.
The fact again, like the Mr. Show, I love the way that it just builds from one joke to the other. It's all about. They keep adding and adding. Kind of like Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's all about the big payoff at the end.
Right, right.
How the joke develops, such as it just starts off with the 4 friends and they're basically playing cards. And they're all coming up with these like outlandish things, but it's the guy with the normal sort of dream that doesn't come to fruition, but all the others who've got like these wild ass dreams of like being a pope and Supreme Judge and that, they all
come
true. The
world's first popularly elected pope. Yeah, and that's the thing. Poor Mike just couldn't give up eating meat. And I love that thing at the end with the ad for David Cross's telecom company there at the end. It's like, fuck you, Mike, I did it in the ad.
But yeah, I did kind of have me a bit worried when you got the opening joke where they're in the time machine. Which is basically just a porta potty.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this isn't particularly good. And then it's like slowly found its rhythm over like the episode as it went on. And some of it kind of I got after I watched it, which I don't know if it's like me and my slow uptake or whatnot. But and some of it was just funny instantly. But I've enjoyed the first episode. I've yet to watch the others. But it's reassuring to know that it's worth watching, which is always a bit of a concern when you bring back a show which has been sort of had its run.
Right.
I know we were saying before we came on about the Muppets that you were saying like a lot of people stateside have sort of felt it's very mean-spirited, which
yeah.
I personally haven't.
That's the criticism I'm seeing the most. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. Hopefully, like in the month between Christmas and every show in the world I watch, starting in February, I think, hopefully I'll be able to get some episodes in.
I mean, is there anything else that's sort of your attention?
Not from me. What about from you?
For myself, well, obviously I'm still plodding through Walking Dead. I mean, what, we're on season 6 now?
Season 6, yeah.
We've had a major sort of cliffhanger of sorts with referring to the fate of Glenn. But, of course, it's kind of been overshadowed with the casting of Negan. By Jeffrey Dean Stanton.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Who was obviously in The Losers. He played the comedian in Watchmen. Probably one of my favorite underrated actors. He's up there with Jeremy Piven.
I don't see him in a whole lot, but he was as uneven as I thought the Watchmen movie was. I thought he was perfect as the comedian.
Yeah.
And I also really liked him. He had a recurring gig on Supernatural as the Winchester boy's father.
I mean, yeah, he's, if you look on his IMDb page, he's worked a lot. He's like Robert Patrick or Mitch Pileggi. He's a working actor. He's like constantly been in things. It's just some things been more high profile than others.
Right.
But I think the character Negan, who anyone who's familiar with the comic books will know already, is a real nasty piece of work. And is responsible probably for one of the most memorable deaths in the comic series, and one which the fans and I believe many of the showrunners have actually been fighting to include in the show. Whether it's going to fall on the same character or not is yet to be determined.
Right.
But there has been some footage leaked from the set which shows them seemingly filming the scene, but of course no one's able to tell who the fate falls upon.
Right.
I mean, are you familiar with the comics at all?
I'm not familiar with the Walking Dead comic book, but I know enough people who are that I actually know who the character is you're talking about. I know who Negan is, and I know the death you're talking. I'm pretty sure I know the death you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, basically the character Negan, he's just a foul-mouthed thug in a way. Has his like army of psychotic followers, and he's basically like the Walking Dead's version of Joffrey in a way, that he's a complete psychopath. If his followers don't follow him, he burns them, so he like puts an iron on their face and like marks them out as being traitors. But he's got this real sort of trademark look of like the leather jacket and a barbed wire wrapped baseball bat,
right,
which he calls Lucille.
Yep.
And there's also, he has a number of great lines in the comic, including one of my personal favorites, such as, "My dick is so hard I should wrap it in barbed wire and call it Lucille too."
Dear God.
Whether we're going to get such lines like this, I mean, he has another line which is like a 9 expletive rant. I'd be interested to see if they get that past the censors.
It is AMC, so but AMC will let them get away with a little bit more than in broadcast network would it.
At the same time, it's just really sort of encompassing what I'm getting bored about the series. It's just becoming this real sadistic sort of fantasy. It's sort of this like legalized murder fantasy that's kind of playing out. I care less about these characters, and it just seems to be this constant stream of, oh, what gory death can we come up with this week?
It's turning into Sons of Anarchy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been bored with the show for a while now. It's more the feeling I've come so far, and it's not quite irritating me enough to give up on it, like with Lost.
Right.
Or like anything made by Ryan Murphy. That I'm kind of sort of dragging my way through it, and occasionally something exciting happened, but I'm not as excited as I was like back in those early seasons, certainly. So
right.
It'd be interesting to obviously see if this whole storyline with Nugent, if they managed to carry it across and it sparked some enthusiasm like the Governor plotline back in season four, three.
I don't remember.
which is what I needed, but yeah, Walking Dead for me is, I'm kind of dragging it in there, but the zombie genre on a whole has become very tiresome and worn out.
Yeah, it's something that I haven't, Walking Dead is one of those shows, and it really wore off, the zombie thing really wore off for me years ago, to the point where I couldn't really even go beyond the pilot with Walking Dead back in 2010.
Obviously being a horror blogger, I mean, this is your field. I mean, do you find that's the reason you're sort of more burnt out on zombies more than sort of like a more mainstream audience would be?
Definitely. I mean, there was definitely a time, probably about 2008 to 2010, 2011, where it was just like every third thing that was coming down the pike was something with zombies. I mean, I remember, when was it? I remember walking through a grocery store and looking at the book rack and seeing that there were a line of young adult oriented books where a flesh-eating zombie was the main character. I can't guarantee it was the Warm Bodies books, but I just remember thinking to myself, 1979, this was, shocking as hell, and now they're, it's Sweet Valley High territory.
Yeah. It's obviously with Romero and those sort of masters. I mean, Romero especially was making a statement with his zombie movies, and then I think really the last good zombie movie we had, and, I'm going to be a little controversial here, but would be the James Gunn remake of Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, I love the James Gunn remake.
I love it, but it, as I said, I know a lot of people are going to go, oh, what about 28 Days Later? Surely that was better, but it was okay. I mean, it's lost a lot in just the fact that it set the benchmark for what zombies now have to be.
Right.
I certainly was more excited by what James Gunn did with the material and how he adapted and made it his own.
Right.
Which is unsurprising why Romero himself actually liked it.
Oh yeah, I mean I really really like the remake of Dawn of the Dead, but there's like it's kind of like a second tier one to me. Along with 28 Days Later, it doesn't quite go up to like the originality and just the shocking nature of certain movies that have really, like, some of my favorite zombie movies the past few years have been really kind of out there, like minor low. Independent low budget productions like Pontypool and The Battery, and those are kind of like, I think, a cut above, but definitely, I mean, 28 Days Later definitely gave me what I was looking for. Dawn of the Dead, the remake, really gave me what I was looking for. It wasn't, I mean, James Gunn, he went in there, he gave it his all. Everybody gave it their all. They came up with a fresh take on the basic concept. They didn't pull any punches. And, it was a lot more... Certainly it's better than anything George Romero's done with zombies, since returning, to making zombie movies with Land of the Dead. And I'm saying this is someone who liked Land of the Dead.
Yeah, I mean, I like Land of the Dead. The problem with Romero is that he's making zombie movies because people want him to make these movies. He's kind of stuck as the grandfather of zombie movies. He's like the overlord of his domain, and people want him to make them. And I mean, the only reason he's making them, as he's frequently said himself, is the fact that people want him to be making them. So
right.
He's and really just, you know, supply and demand. I mean, it's...
making movies is better than not making movies. So if he has to make movies about zombies, he'll make movies about zombies.
Yeah.
Although I guess his comic book is AMC picked up the rights to do his comic book. I think it's like Empire of the Dead. I guess they picked up the rights to do that as a TV show.
I haven't seen Empire, so it'd be completely new to myself.
Yeah, I haven't. I guess it's a comic book he and his son have been writing. I could be wrong about who's involved, but I know he's been writing a comic book. That's where everybody's going these days, is comic books.
Yeah. I think that's the next thing, though, is we're just back into the comic book properties and seeing what we can adapt. I mean, speaking of which, the new Supergirl adaptation, I've really been enjoying.
I remember when I first saw the ad, the first ad for it, I said, okay, this doesn't look earth-shatteringly original.
Yeah.
But it looks entertaining. And then so many people were just like, oh my God, they made it all girly and stuff. Oh God, this is going to suck when it comes out. And then, it's like, I don't know, something, I just have a good feeling. I haven't seen it, but it's just like, I had a feeling that it wasn't going to kind of sink like a stone. And then they started airing it, and it was like, the reviews were good. And people, it's, you know, positive, and the reviews have been positive, and people have been liking it.
I think what's nice about it is that it's a lighthearted superhero series.
Right.
It's not dark and, oh, we're full of angst and that. It's, you know, it's a lighthearted series. Clarissa Flockhart in it is fantastic. Basically, all they seem to have done is just took the format for Superman, as in, like, the Lois and Clark adventures, where Dean came.
Right,
and
right.
And swapped genders around, and Jimmy Reed's now black. Which I believe is in the comics now, so...
Okay.
Sorry, Jimmy Olsen is now black. Which, again, no problem with that. When we changed Nick Fury to being Samuel Jackson in the comic books. Mm-hmm. So no problems with that. It works. I'm still buying the character. And it's fun seeing, basically, Supergirl, and she's having to learn how to be Supergirl.
Right.
Because she spent all this time hiding her powers and living a normal life, whereas Clark Kent was sort of like, learning how to use his powers as he was growing up. So it's right. Fun seeing her trying to sort of fumble her way through being a superhero and learning how to control her powers. So I've only seen the first 3 episodes, but so far I've enjoyed it. It's not earth-shatteringly great, but it, you know, it's enjoyable.
Right.
It takes up an hour of your time, and it's not, you don't feel like it's an hour wasted.
Right.
But other than that, it's just been mainly a lot of tech comedies I've been watching. I've been revisiting Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And I powered through the only season of Betas, which is an Amazon original.
Okay,
which,
I don't think I've heard of that one.
Okay, Betas is essentially the less foul-mouthed cousin of Silicon Valley.
Okay.
It's on Amazon Prime. It was only done as one season, which seems like kind of a shame because these characters are really enjoyable. Again, like Silicon Valley, it's about these whiz kids living in the San Fernando Valley and developing their app and basically trying to get it to market and, you know, create a name for themselves. And it's just both go about their own unique ways of how they approach the subject and that. Silicon Valley, for myself, is a superior show, but mm-hmm. Betas provides a suitable stopgap between series.
Okay.
Especially as we're waiting for season 3. But Silicon Valley is so smart you wouldn't believe that it was produced by the guy who gave us Beavis and Butthead.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard some good things about... There's a number of kind of like tech-oriented comedy, not just comedies, but series. I've been meaning to check out Silicon Valley. I did actually check out a couple of episodes of... it's not a comedy, but it's a period piece about the early days of PC development called Halt and Catch Fire.
Okay.
And that's been pretty good. If you have... I don't know... if this show would get anywhere near you, years ago, back in the late to the way you're describing Silicon Valley, late, I think about 2008, the CBC Canadian did a show called J-Pod.
Now, that's the show I was going to just bring up next.
Yeah.
I watched the first episode. It's on Amazon Prime again.
Oh, good.
And it is garbage.
Oh, you didn't like it?
I watched the first episode, and I'm watching it, and it's going, wow, are you people ever trying hard? It's got very much the feeling I'm feeling with the new latest season of Big Bang, in that it's just trying so hard to appeal and make these characters seem like, oh, we're hip, we're like Google, you know, Google employees, we're, you know, playing Death Race with model cars. And I've read the book, and I really enjoyed the book, and I don't know if that gave me too much of an expectation.
Right.
I mean, Douglas Coupland as an author is original, to say the least. He certainly writes in a way no other author I have read does. He's got a very disposable sort of way, but goes off on weird tangents with his writing that you kind of buy, kind of like Murakami.
Uh-huh.
In that sort of way that he can go off in random tangents, but somehow bring it back to his main story, and you don't mind. But the series, it just felt like it was trying so hard, and I don't know whether it's because I watched Betas and Silicon Valley, which essentially are doing the same thing, but better and smarter.
Uh-huh.
Especially with the terms of Silicon Valley, where you've got, like, the head of Yahoo signing up to be a Satanist.
Oh, God.
But they're like the most good-natured Satanists. They're sitting around in this room, and they've got, like, a papier-mâché goat's head.
Uh-huh.
And you've got the high priest of Satanism who's like does the ceremony. He's like then questioning if anyone needs the parking ballot in. If you only watch one, Silicon Valley will be the one to watch.
Uh-huh.
And while you're obviously waiting for the new season, just check out Betas, because it's...
All right.
It provides a nice stopgap. It has an ending, even though I would have liked to have seen it continue further. And Egg Bailey Jr. is absolutely fantastic as their sweary sort of boss slash investor.
Okay.
Who basically just spends a lot of time just swearing at people, which is just really funny for Egg Bailey Jr. playing this sort of character.
Hey, I'd pay to listen to him swear for 30 minutes.
But, yeah, I mean, Silicon Valley, yes, it is. There's a lot of foul language and stuff, which is to be expected of the guy who did Boots and Bear. But, again, it has this wonderful opening scene where they're at a startup company party where this app's recently been sold for, like, millions of dollars. And you got Kid Rock playing in the background, but everyone's ignoring him because they're just all, like, you know, techies and just social introverts, and they're there drinking like blended prawn, and one of them goes, he's like, oh, what does it taste like? And he's like, wow, I always wanted to know what cum tastes like.
Well, I guess if I had to guess it's what blended prawn would taste like.
So I've it's for my money, Silicon Valley is still one of my favorite shows at the moment, and it held up to a rewatch. I'm currently rewatching season 2 at the moment, but it's smart, it's funny, and I think it perfectly satires that world of tech investment, especially in this sort of like world where technology is moving so fast, and you've got everyone seemingly has an app for everything.
Yeah.
I think it perfectly captures that, and it presents a lot of technological data in an accessible way. Yeah, I think that's really about it. That, and I finally started watching Orange is the New Black, you know,
right,
4 years after everyone else, or whatever, however long that show's been on. Which, again, it's been good. The second series, I'm struggling more to get into, but the first season was a fun ride, but it's fun to see Laura Petty, who memorably played Tank Girl, showing up in this.
Yeah, Tank Girl. That's all I have to say about that. I did the Tank Girl movie.
It was good. It was
interesting. I guess if somebody had to try to make a live-action version of Jamie Howlett's or Hewlett or whatever his name is, Brain, I guess that's as good as any.
Yeah.
But
the problem with Tango is it's the result of what happens if you take drugs and write comics. The film is the result of what happens if you take drugs and try to make movies, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a fun... I enjoy it. It's certainly a cult movie.
Yeah.
To say the least.
Almost as if you have an interest in cult movies.
Hmm. Who'd have thought?
Who'd have thought? So, are you ready to talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Yes. Let's get into it.
Let's discuss some Buffy.
Okay. As you said already, this is from season 1. It's episode 8. The title being I, Robot, You, Jane. if you're not familiar with the episode, this was actually one of the first Willow-centric episodes of the series. And in it, she finds herself in an online relationship with a boy only known as Malcolm. Unaware that Malcolm is actually the demon Moloch, the Corrupter, whose soul has been released into the digital realm after the book holding him captive was scanned unwittingly by Willow. This is an episode which really emphasizes where technology was in the 90s. So watching it now, like if you watch Perfect Blue, a lot of it's going to seem a bit strange if you weren't sort of around at the time. So for our younger listeners out there, they may find it a bit weird, such as people not understanding what a website is or how a computer works.
Or confusing the words, what, skim and scan?
Yeah. And we also have such wonderful characters such as the psycho, computer-obsessed Fritz.
Yeah.
Who comes out with these wonderful, like, cyberpunk rants such as, the printed page is obsolete. Information isn't bound up anymore. It's an entity. The only reality is virtual. If you're not jacked in, you're not alive.
It's like, and I love the way you put a lot more emphasis on certain words in there than he did. I think he kind of said it kind of like in a generic angry voice, whereas you made it sound like it like was a trailer that like Moss and, you know, Roy would have been watching in like an episode of the IT Crowd.
He's like so intense. This kid is.
He talks so intensely, and he talks like a Bruce Sterling novel.
but yeah, and he's just got this like constant intense look on his face. He's just angry all the time. They're only like kids of the 90s. That's the angry that only like 90s grunge kids could pull off.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is an episode. It's memorable for not only its handling of computer technology. It also introduced us to the techno-pagan Jenny, who would have much more of a larger role in the sort of coming seasons. And it also has a robot demon at the climax, which is fun. I mean, this is one of my favorite all-time episodes. I know there's a lot of Buffy fans out there who would disagree. I mean, Lucky, you're sort of on-off Buffy fan, I'm right in saying?
I've never been a fan. I've watched maybe a handful of episodes over the years. I understand that there's a lot of people that, I mean, Buffy is one of those shows that has really, I think, really reached a lot of people, and really important to a lot of people. But to me, I just never could get into it. This is probably one of the episodes that I probably responded to the best. It's got a lot of camp elements to it. It's pretty cheesy. And I did have to keep reminding myself at certain points, okay, this is like 1997,
yeah.
Low budget show on 1997. It's like even the X-Files didn't look all that great in its first season, you know. And Buffy, if I remember correctly, Buffy was always at the cult level. It was never a gigantic breakout hit.
No.
Yeah, it always ran on like one of the minor networks over here, and it never really got like huge amounts of. I mean, it was a breakout hit by the standards of that network. You know, it's a network that went on to do Smallville and Supernatural. You know, but even those shows, they wouldn't have. You know, those shows. You know, the followings they have are fairly minor compared to stuff like Dancing with the Stars or Survivor, whatever it is that pulls in 25 million in the quote unquote demo. It's got this sort of charming sort of mid-90s-ness to about it. The makeup on the demon I thought was actually really good. The cold open actually kind of recreates this sort of Italian. Because it starts off with a flashback to the 15th century and the binding of Moloch.
Yeah.
And it looks, I thought, so much. The director did such a great job, I think, of like making it look like an actual like Italian exploitation horror movie that I was kind of expecting at some point to actually be a movie that the characters in the modern day were watching on TV.
Oh, it's unquestionably camped up. I mean, we've got like monks, we've got the character Moloch, who's this big green horned demon who seduces his followers with love, and he promises them like power and glory and love in return. And all the fact that they've got to do is just like follow him unquestioningly, and he will like grant them all this power. You know, despite the fact he's very obviously a demon, none of his followers seem to have any problems going along with this.
I just love how he says, "I just want you to love me." And it was particularly in the end, at the end of the episode, where he's the robot and you can hear this computerized voice, "I just want you to love me." I kept thinking, you know what? Somebody should just take this episode and take the end of it and just overdub it with the voice of GLaDOS from the Portal games. It would just be so perfect. Willow, with all your destruction, the only thing you have truly succeeded in breaking is my heart. It was actually, I thought, fairly solidly entertaining. It's not I don't think it's the episode that's going to convert me into a Buffy fan.
No.
I felt that it could have been. I like the basic idea of kind of like. I remember reading, and someone was talking about Buffy. And they were talking about how they were, like, the genius of Buffy is basically how it takes, like, the trials and tribulations of teenage life and kind of puts them into the metaphor of fighting demons and vampires and monsters and what have you.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea here, and this is the nice thing when they have the little wrap-up at the end, where, at the very end, where it's like, well, you know, my first kiss turned out to be a vampire. And kind of like that, I felt it could have been maybe a little bit more satirical in that end. I also really, for whatever reason, the title just kind of struck me as kind of, I don't know, weird, considering that there are no Asimov or Tarzan references in the entire episode that at least I caught.
I feel that the iRobot, I mean, he does essentially become a robot at the end.
Right.
He's this cyber presence, and this is really, again, ties in with the times. I mean, in the 90s, we had the Y2K hysteria when this was sort of coming out. I mean, also at this point, we're dealing with things such as noisy modems, you know, going whole nights and seeing perhaps one naked lady.
Right.
On the internet.
I particularly like the bit where, you know, oh my God, Willow's in danger. Try calling Willow. And they knew Willow wasn't home because they could actually call her. They could get through. They knew she wasn't home because if she was home, she'd be online and they'd get a busy signal. You know, that was a nice little touch, blast from the past.
And I think it was this idea that computers at the time were going to take over and they would like be launching missiles. And it'd be like war games. We'd just have like nuclear missiles like launching up, being controlled by this sentient being. And for the most part, I mean, Moloch really is that. He, like, can control computers. I mean, he guides his followers, who seemingly are more than happy to just follow what's being told to them via a message on a computer screen.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got his two main followers here. We've got the Scowling Fitz, who we've mentioned already. It's kind of more understandable why he's so willing to follow. And then we've got, like, the socially awkward Dave, who gets drawn into this sort of scheme that Moloch has and at one point tries to electrocute Buffy in probably the most elaborate setup I've seen, where he tries to electrocute her in a shower.
Right.
Which again has that wonderful follow-up where she's more concerned about her hair.
Yeah.
Than the fact she's almost been killed.
And I just love Xander's response. It's the best hair. It's one of your best hair.
It's your best hair ever.
It's your best hair ever.
And yeah, and obviously at this point in the series, Buffy has yet to accept her role as the Slayer.
Right.
She's more sort of fighting the role. She wants to be the normal high school girl, but at the same time, she knows she's sort of tasked with, you know, defeating vampires and defending Sunnydale from the darkness, which obviously comes on a weekly basis because it's built on Hellmouth.
Right.
So it attracts evil and demonic presences. So.
Which is why one assumes the Sunnyvale High School, or Sunnydale, or whatever the town is called, has its own rare books department.
It has, and they're all in the school library.
Yeah. And actually, one of the really charming things I thought about the episode is that Giles thought that Miss Callender was going to freak out when he told her about the demon of the internet. When they're sitting, they're scanning Eldritch Tomes right in front of her at the beginning of the episode. You know, it's like, here's an Eldritch Tome. Scan it in, Willow. You know, and then while they were having this, and it was just really, I thought, awkward kind of, it's predicated on the idea of, you know, Giles being the sort of shut-in who, or I wouldn't necessarily, maybe not shut-in, but something of a Luddite.
Yeah.
Somebody who's not really comfortable with technology. And, you know, this sort of almost, I can tell that it was like the writers were almost trying to go with, like, this kind of screwball comedy banter between the two characters, Giles and Jenny.
Yeah.
Where you have, it's like, well, I prefer to curl up with a good book. And, you know, that, it's like, the idiot box is the bad box. This is the good box. Leading into Fritz's, information wants to be free. The printed page is obsolete. You know?
You know, all these missing...
That's not how Fritz sounded. But,
the scenes with Giles and Jenny are probably some of my favorite moments of the episode. Just the fact that they just constantly trade barbs back and forth. And as you said, Giles is like very stuck in his ways. He feels that, you know, we shouldn't depend on technology and, you know, that somehow technology is going to replace this like interaction, that like real interaction between people.
Right.
Which I guess he was probably on something, seeing as now no one really seems to talk to each other. They just message ideas and things across to each other. It's so maybe he was like a bit of a soothsayer on that one.
Yeah, there is something I thought really pressing, particularly when he was talking about, you know, privacy and spying. But yeah, probably my favorite scene, and the one that I think probably rung most true to me emotionally, was that scene between the two of them after, in the aftermath of, you know, doing the ritual, bringing the ritual online and binding Moloch back into the book, or actually trying to bind Moloch back into the book, and then all that stuff at the factory, where, you know, that he has this, you know, almost like heartfelt, you know, makes this heartfelt confession. It's like, actually, I'm less comfortable around computers than I ever was after this. You know, I thought that was, and that really, I think, really demonstrates the value of having an actor of the caliber of Anthony Head in that role as part of the ensemble, because I'm a fan of his, and I've liked him ever since he did his guest turn on Doctor Who, probably about 10 years ago now, and it just really, really worked.
See, the thing with Anne Stewart Head is I really liked him in Buffy. Before this, I think the only thing he was known for was advertising, I think it was Nescafe or Maxwell House, so he was doing coffee commercials.
And he was probably, I expect in Britain, he was known as the brother of the guy who sang One Night in Bangkok.
No?
No, he didn't? Oh, okay. Well,
okay. I know that he seems to have convinced himself that he can sing, as anyone who's seen Repo the Genetic Opera can sort of testify to, but I wish he wouldn't sing.
one of my friends, a big fan of Repo the Genetic Opera, and then she watched the Sweeney Todd musical version,
okay.
The John with Johnny Depp, and she was like, why did they cast Johnny Depp as Sweeney Todd when Anthony Stewart Head can sing so well?
I mean, at this point in the season, it's hard to obviously see where a lot of these characters go as they obviously develop. And the people like Giles, and especially the main Scooby members, so Giles and Xander and Willow, and that they're still at the very much base level. So Giles has yet to show any of his darker moments, such as we see like in Halloween, where we find out about his wild child past, where he was like raising demons and like this leather jacket wearing thug. Okay. And obviously Willow's yet to become a lesbian witch, and Xander's,
right.
Well, Xander doesn't really change much over the course of the series, but you know, he becomes funnier.
The episode really, and I mean, even some of the bigger Buffy fans that I know have even said that the series really doesn't find its footing until the second season.
Yeah, I would say this first season, it's very much a creature of the week style,
right.
Season. And it was great because it obviously set up a lot of the characters, and in the second series it became more, okay, we're going to do the big evil. and were focused less on sort of the creature of the week. And, you know, characters started to becoming more powerful and started accepting their roles within the universe and that. So while this first season certainly doesn't have, be seen as not as strong as the later seasons, there's still a lot of really enjoyable episodes, such as this one, which really sort of stood out. There's another episode with Claire Duval,
yeah, from Carnival,
who plays an invisible girl. And one of the last scenes it shows, and she's in a classroom full of invisible students, and they're being trained to carry out like assassinations and be like government hitmen.
Well,
so it's again, Josh Whedon's always had some really great ideas, and he manages to perfectly balance, as this episode shows again, this line between horror and comedy.
Right.
And let's not forget, I mean, he's switching the roles. Rather than the monster chasing the pretty girl, we got the pretty girl chasing the monsters.
Right.
And it has this effect of, like, oh, Buffy and Willow, and she's hot, and oh my god, a monster! And it sort of catches you off guard.
Yeah, and it's not something, it subverts your expectations. Maybe not as much, and maybe I'm at a disadvantage here, coming almost 20 years after the first season, not being all that familiar, you know. But I can imagine in the mid to late 90s, when the show originally debuted, the subversion of that expectation and how surprising and fresh that must have been at the time, you know, because... You know, we're still kind of in a we're still kind of having these discussions now about strong female characters.
I think certainly Buffy was and still is a standout female character, and this is a show that was based on a failed movie.
Oh yeah,
which is surprising enough to begin with. And I mean, this was a late season filler. It wasn't like a show they expected to take off. It was just something that they sort of created to fill in on the second half of the TV season.
Right.
And it took off, and I mean, the first season, I believe, was only 12 episodes long compared to the 22 of the season which followed it. So no one expected it to be the success it was. The other thing you got to remember as well, at this point, being like mid, so as you said, late 90s, sort of geek and nerd culture hadn't taken off the same way it has now, where we've got all this like nerd chic and the rest of it, and you can go and buy any number of things to sort of expand upon your hobby.
Right.
These things were very much like Star Wars. It was like this secret handshake you had between yourself and your fellow nerds, and it was all like, oh, you like that show? I like that show too. And it's sort of what bound you together.
Right.
The fact it had an attractive girl in it who kicks ass was just really an added bonus. And the fact it featured monsters, you know, didn't have any other shows that were featured monsters. It's not like now where we've got like True Blood and Walking Dead and iZombie. We've got all these shows which take horror themes and ideas. This was a truly original sort of show. And
it certainly, there are so many shows that really, with watching this one episode, it sort of made these connections, all these other shows that came down the pike, that you wouldn't necessarily think, that you wouldn't have Supernatural without Buffy, for example.
No.
You know, even though it's male-led, you know, it's still, in many ways, it's Buffy on the road.
Yeah, no, I think, again, you only have to, its presence is just continually felt, and the fact we're, as you said, we just continually refer back to Buffy. When if you have a strong female character, and just what it sort of sparked on. I mean, obviously, this series led on to Angel, the sort of darker cousin, which gave David Boreanaz sort of a way to do the Buffy themes, but we're more dark and more adult edge, as we'll probably discuss on later episodes when we look at episodes of Angel. And it would have been nice to obviously have seen the other proposed spin-off, because at one point they were proposing, the BBC were going to do a spin-off.
A Giles spin-off,
yeah,
is what
called,
I heard, yeah.
Ripper. We were also going to see a spin-off based around the sort of bad girl slayer Faith, which again would have been like Buffy on the road, where she would like being constantly on the road and, you know, encountered evil, but it's sort of like got passed because they decided to do Dollhouse instead, which I think it remains for history to decide whether that was a good or a bad idea ultimately. But
yeah, I I am not, and I'm going to say this. I'm going to say this up front. Okay. I am not the biggest fan of Eliza Dushku.
How dare you?
And yeah, I know. and I don't. I never watched Dollhouse because I just, for everything I'd seen, everything I'd seen her do, she just didn't seem to possess the range necessary for the role.
Okay.
You know, I don't think I've seen any Faith episodes. I've seen her basically do what I understand to be the Faith type character in several movies. You know, kind of like she's almost kind of gotten stereotyped as kind of like the tough bad girl chick.
Yeah.
But it's just, there is just something about her as an, I mean, it's not that she's, I mean, she's certainly attractive, but there is just something about her as an actress that just, I don't know.
Okay.
It goes back to Wrong Turn, I think, which is the first thing I ever saw her in.
Okay. I really like Wrong Turn. I've yet to work my way through, like, the numerous sequels that it surprisingly spawned now.
I know. I remember hearing they were like on Wrong Turn 6 or 7 now. I'm like, how the hell did that happen?
Yeah. I think we're about 6 now.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a weighty box set that they're building, so.
Well,
I think the only other thing I wanted to talk about is the ending where we have the robot Malak, and at this point he's plugged into the internet and he's able to see like bank transactions, and it's sort of, oh, a son has just transferred money to free his mother. That's nice.
Right, yeah. in Beijing, a man has just put a contract out on his mother. And this is kind of foreshadowed throughout the episode. There's an early bit where there's a kid. I don't think it's Dave, but there's a kid with a nice clunky vintage 1995 Power Mac.
Is that what it is? I wasn't sure if it was like a
power
laptop
book,
or what.
I think it was. I couldn't really tell what it was, but I'm just saying power book. This clunky thing saying, this isn't what I wrote. This isn't my term paper. This term paper is entitled, you know, Nazi Germany is a model for the well-ordered society. You know? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's, you know, they made the trains run on time, kid. You got to learn a few things. But yeah, they foreshadow that, and then they have throughout the episode, there's this one scene, I think, where somebody's watching TV, and there's a newscaster, and it's actually Joss Whedon's voice, and he's talking about, like, financial chaos in Europe or something like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, at the end, Moloch gets disconnected from the net, and he's basically trapped in his robot body, and we have, like, the inevitable showdown. And it's kind of sad that this was the only appearance of Moloch, because I really would have liked him to have come back as like this cyber sort of presence, kind of like Lawnmower Man. And that we just have like this, like a message just like appearing on an isolated computer screen. And I know it's like that sort of cliche ending, you know, like Lawnmower Man, like the X-Files episode Ghost in the Machine, where, you know, you just have like the computer boot up and it's like just this message that shows that he's still out there.
Right.
But, you know, it sadly never was. He was a one-shot character. And
I was actually kind of surprised that they didn't have that little tease that, oh, he's still out there.
Yeah. But, you know, it would seem sadly not to be. And seeing how there's a lot of people who don't like this episode, they're probably, like, glad that they didn't do that. But for myself, it was always kind of like, well, there are a few missed opportunities for the show.
Uh-huh.
Normally, when they had these one-shot characters, it was fine. You were done with this sort of character. And this was like one of the few times I felt, you know, I would have liked to have seen him again. You know, mm-hmm. not perhaps in the robot form, maybe in a different sort of guise or something. But
right.
But I don't know. Maybe it was just a desire to see more cyberpunk on TV.
Maybe. Or maybe it was just your Fritz fandom.
Maybe.
The printed page is obsolete.
And what does he get him? He gets his neck broken.
Yeah.
So that's
I do have to say, the thing that really kind of bugged me about this episode is like two teenagers die and like the rest of the episode nobody mentions it. It's like at the end they're laughing and it's like, but two teenagers are dead. This is like The town would be swarming with media, but I guess it's maybe it's a side effect of the whole Hellmouth thing.
They kind of like it's funny you should mention that because there's numerous nods over the series. When we see Seth Green's character Oz, who appears and he's like first realizes that there's vampires exist, and his response was, "Oh, I guess that kind of explains a lot of what happens around here." And like Buffy's mother just kind of just passes it off. It's like, "Oh, that happened. That was weird." She's kind of like has her own unique way of dealing with it. It certainly within the early sort of seasons. Uh-huh. When it gets into the late seasons, she obviously finds out that Buffy is a slayer and insists on doing like mother daughter slaying outings.
Hey.
But yeah, Fritz actually gets a listing in the Sunnydale yearbook, where it causes death a loss to the future technology.
Well.
And possibly death metal as well.
Mm-hmm. Very possibly.
Yeah. But yeah, Fritz, probably one of the most intense characters of the whole series.
Fritz should have had his own spinoff, I'm just saying.
I love his mantra as well. I'm jacked in, I'm jacked in,
I'm jacked in. I'm jacked in, I'm jacked in. He's like carving runes into his arm.
I mean, you're a computer sort of guy, am I right in saying?
I have never, ever in my life said that I'm jacked in.
I'm about to say, you like, I have, and you're like...
Okay, like, I was on the internet. Okay, I was like on the internet in 1992, I think.
Yeah.
And this was actually before the web. I have never, and I was actually like reading like stuff like William Gibson novels and Bruce Sterling's wonderful nonfiction treatise on hacker culture, which is called The Hacker Crackdown, about the rise of hacker culture in America and the big paranoia on the part of the FBI, where. There was a game company in Texas that published a cyberpunk role-playing game, and the FBI raided their offices and shut them down for a while because they thought it was a real guide on how to commit cybercrime. I mean, this was 1990. I can tell you in my life, I have never gone around saying I'm jacked in, and I have never used the term cyberspace non-ironically.
Okay.
My absolute favorite remark about that is the miniseries Wild Palms from the early 90s. William Gibson has a brief cameo in it when somebody introduces him as the guy. This is the guy who coined the term cyberspace, and he says, "They won't let me forget it."
Yeah, cyberspace, whenever I hear it, it makes me think of things like Reboot. Uh-huh. Again, Lawnmower Man in the Johnny Mnemonic.
Johnny Mnemonic, yeah.
Johnny Mnemonic and that stupid dolphin.
Johnny Mnemonic, the movie about which my friend Sean said, if your lead actor's being out-acted by Dolph Lundgren, you have a problem.
Cool. I mean, if you've got anything else you want to sort of discuss this one?
I think that just about covers what I was going to say about this.
Okay. If you are a fellow Buffy fan, make sure you check out channelsuperhero.com, who are our partners with the show now, where you can find... all episodes of our show on their site now. And you can also find my ongoing revisit of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Currently we're on season 2 at the moment, as of the time of recording. So if you want to catch up, share your thoughts on Buffy, maybe read up a few episode guides. It's all on there, as well as a whole bunch of other great shows, both current shows such as Supergirl, Flash, Gotham, Walking Dead. We've also got some real throwback shows such as the original Batman, as well as we're looking at some web series on there such as Bad Days and John Con Noir. But plenty of reading on there if you're a fan of Superhero TV. So check it out now, channelsuperhero.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we'll be looking at Lackey's selection for this show, which is The Booth at the End.
All right, Kristen, I am so excited that you've decided to do a podcast with me, but what are we going to do a podcast about? There's so many other movie podcasts. We got to do something original.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Disney movies. What about something like that?
That's just kid stuff. What do we want to do that for?
Did you know that The Avengers is a Disney movie? Or that Pulp Fiction is a Disney movie?
Pulp Fiction is not a Disney movie.
It's technically owned by Miramax, which is part of Disney.
We are still going to talk about the Disney animated movies, though, right?
I thought you said that was kid stuff.
Well, you know, I've got two kids. I got to be a good dad and stuff.
So be sure to subscribe to the Walt Sent Me podcast, where we discuss the various subsidiaries of the Walt Disney Studios, including the animated movies.
It's available on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts. And I swear, it's not kid stuff.
And we would like to thank that member of the Glam Podcasting Network for letting us use their trailer and go listen to them. They're pretty cool, whoever they are, I'm sure. All right. Next on our docket is The Booth at the End. This was a short-lived, both in terms of episode length, season length, and series length, Canadian show. It ran for a whopping 10 episodes, two seasons, in 2010 and 2012. 2 5-episode seasons, each episode about 20 minutes apiece. The basic setup is, it's a very simple setup. Xander Berkeley, the character actor probably best known for playing, do you know him for playing anybody other than John Connor's foster father?
I'm about to say, if I was to place him, it would be like the guy who got killed, John Connor's stepfather, who gets the really cool death in Terminator 2.
Right.
That's, other than that, he was in Nikita as well.
Yeah, he's done a bunch of stuff. I just don't, and it's a distinctive name, but it's I can't really place his face in a lot of stuff. I just remember him from Terminator 2.
Yeah, and I mean, again, he's another working actor.
Right.
To mention before, I mean, he's in Gattaca at the end. I mean, he's one of those actors you see him as like, oh, he's that guy.
Right.
But I mean, he played the lead actress's husband in Candyman.
Oh, he's like, that's always, right. Oh, God.
He's always there. He's very rarely like a lead role. So obviously, this was a rarity, him being a lead role in something.
Right.
But yeah, he's always there. But I mean, he was also in 24. I mean, he was George Mason in that. So.
Yes, that's. Oh, yeah, that's right. That.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You know him.
Yeah. In The Booth at the End, Xander Berkeley plays the man. He has no name. He sits in the booth at the end of a row at a diner, and people come up to him. He sits around writing all day in his little ledger, ordering food, eating, and people come up and visit him. And it's basically, if you want something done, he can help you out. If there's something that you want, you tell him what it is you want. He'll look in his little ledger and tell you what you have to do in exchange for that, for you to get what you want. He's almost sort of like a Mephistophelian-type character, except he doesn't seem to be, and many, once or twice throughout the season, he says, I don't control as much as you think. But various characters visit him throughout the season. There's Melody, whose father... is going through some financial hardship, and she wants him to have enough money to kind of like make the troubles go away. And her task is to find a shut-in and bring him out into the outside world. Willem is about the creepiest guy you can imagine on this show. He wants to date a centerfold, not any specific centerfold. There's one specific model he wants to date, and in return for that, he has to, if I remember correctly, he has to protect a specific girl.
Yeah, he has to be a guardian angel.
On the other hand, there is James. James's son is sick, and James's task is that he has to kill a child. There's Mrs. Tyler. Mrs. Tyler's husband has dementia. In order to, in order for his dementia to be cured, she has to set off a bomb in a public place and specifically make sure she kills people. There's also Jenny, who just wants to be pretty. She has to rob a bank for a specific sum of money. And one of the more interesting and complex characters is a corrupt cop named Alan. If I remember correctly, he has to he wants to try to pin, he has to kill somebody for his first task. And I can't remember what it is he wanted. It's, I think he wanted somebody like to go to prison.
He wants, originally he wants money.
Yeah.
And with Alan, he's one of the few characters who actually keeps going back to the man, and he keeps getting different tasks assigned to him. Because originally he wants money, and then when he to get the money, he finds out that he has the man who he's got, he has to follow this, basically capture this bank robber, who it turns out is his son.
Right.
And then obviously he goes back to the man and wants another deal. I mean, he wants his son to get away. He doesn't want to turn in his son, even though by turning in his son he can get the money he so desired at the start.
Uh huh.
And this is like one of the first sort of ways that the story sort of interconnect. And you see, as the series obviously goes on, that each of the tasks are designed in a way that they all start to interconnect in a way. And it's very similar in a way to Needful Things.
Yes. It does very much have that kind of Needful Things vibe. And the stories do begin to interconnect. You probably already figured out one way, if you haven't seen the series, that the child that James has decided to kill is the little girl that Willem is supposed to protect. The other one is... Jenny, the girl who has to rob a bank, falls in with Alan's son. And this is one of the points where I thought that just the way Xander Berkeley would say, the cute guy who lives in his car, really...
That's the thing. He's like, basically, she describes him as being a homeless guy who lives in a car, who I can't say is like the most ideal thing. If you're looking to start a relationship with someone, that you go and go out with someone who lives in their car, let alone make them your accomplice when you're robbing banks.
Admittedly, she thought he was fixing it and was just taking a nap in there. But you know, all the way all these stories, and it's a very simple in its setup. It's very simple. There's two locations, inside the restaurant and outside the restaurant. There's usually only about two characters in frame at a time. There's maybe two scenes. There's a couple scenes where Jenny and Richard, who's Alan's son, come together. Actually, one scene. And the other character, kind of recurring character throughout the show, is Doris the waitress, played by Jenny Blong, who I know from a bunch of things, but mainly as the research assistant that Walter Bishop accidentally kills in the backstory to Fringe, who seems to know a little bit more about the man that she and what he's doing than he's letting on. Particularly, these hints are a lot kind of like really kind of hinted more in the second season. But this is just it's fascinating with what you can to show you what you can basically do with like no flashy action, no effects. Just basically talking heads. It's really kind of like an actor's showcase. And there are some really good performances. One of the ones, the characters I didn't talk about was Sister Carmel, who's played by Sarah Chalk or Sarah Clark?
She's played by Sarah Clark.
Sarah Clark, who wasn't she Nina on 24?
Yes, she was.
Yeah. And basically, Sister Carmel's thing is that she's losing faith. She no longer, quote unquote, as she says, hears God. She wants to hear God again. What does she have to do to hear God again? She has to get pregnant. You know, so she's really one of the, it's really like watching her, the subtlety in her performance, the subtlety in Xander Berkeley's performance. And it's just really, really fun to watch. Just basically actors just basically practicing pure craft. The other guy I was really impressed with was the guy who plays Willem, Matt Boren, who Willem is, and it basically starts right off as kind of portraying Willem as the sort of creepy, maybe not like creepy guy who's secretly a serial killer, but a guy who just simply doesn't understand how to conduct himself in society kind of creepy.
Okay. Kind of I didn't get that from him. I just thought he was like just some Joe Schlub who has got this sort of like masturbatory fantasy of dating a centerfold.
Right.
And that in a way it's kind of like The Secret in that his pursuit of this goal actually caused him to improve his life. I mean, he starts off, he's working as a gardener because it means that he can watch over this child. And he realizes that he can't watch over while she's at school, so he gets a job at a janitor at the school as uh-huh. well. And this way he's able to, you know, fulfill his role as the gardener angel. And it's only as the season goes on and he becomes sort of more obsessed with his role as the gardener angel that things start to go astray.
Right.
As we find out that he's kidnapped the child.
I mean, and it's he's decided that basically the best way to make sure she remains safe is to abduct her completely, you know, which that's the sort of point where it's like, and it talks about like he's kind of like slowly improving his life, you know, but there's still this sort of weirdness to him, you know, that it's like, oh yeah, this makes perfect sense. How do I protect somebody? Abduct them. Abduct them, shut them up in a room. Nobody's going to think that's weird.
Yeah. And I love the fact that by him doing this, it changes the character James. Because at this point, James is, Sanders, we mentioned already, he's dying. He's got leukemia, I believe it is. And he's willing to do anything to cure his son. And he's, this idea that he's willing to kill a child because a child... his life hasn't been fully lived. It sort of feels very much nothing to him.
Uh-huh.
But by the end of the season, the fact is he becomes sort of like this redeemed character because he actually kills Willem, we find out, and rescues the child.
Right.
So in a way, while his intentions were less than honorable to start with, he ends up becoming a hero. And in a strange way, he gets his wish.
Yeah.
Even though the man himself says that he doesn't really care if the tasks are completed or not, he sort of just sets the pieces up in play and he kind of knows what the end game is and what needs to be done to get there. He just sort of puts these characters on the right path.
Right. Way, and
for these sort of like cryptic sort of tasks he gives them.
And the series constantly plays with the idea of does he know what's really going on or not? Because he constantly says things like, I have much less control over things than you think. And when people would always say, there's this, I think it's Mrs. Tyler, who says, these things you're going to have me do, these things you would make me do, I'm not making you do anything.
Yeah.
You know, another thing, I think it's... somebody says, it's like, you're making me do this. I did this for you. And he says, no, you did this. You did this for you. You know, and it's really, I think, kind of fascinating. And the device that it continually uses is that part of the deal is not only that you have to go and fulfill this task, you also have to go back and tell him about it. And he's consistently asking these questions, okay? To Jenny, he says, okay, so you broke into the house owned by the father of the cute guy who lives in his car. What was that like? There was this particularly, one of my favorite scenes comes, I think it's in the final episode, where it's, I think it's James. And he's talking to James about saving the little girl. And the man asks him, what was that like? And then James thinks for a minute and he says, purposeful. All of my life, I've just been kind of following events and not really making things my own decisions. I feel like I've just been sort of swept up in events and getting along. And this is one of the few things that I've done in my life where I feel like this is a decision I make. I'm going into it. I have control.
Yeah.
And that's another kind of recurring theme throughout the series is the idea of, you know, to what extent do you control the events of your life? To what extent are you just kind of like swept up in other people's things? To what extent are you a puppet dancing on invisible strings?
I I don't know if you felt the same way, but when you see the character The Man, I can't help but think of the Observers from Fringe.
Yeah, that's kind of, he was kind of put off that sort of, kind of almost detached vibe.
Yeah. Because he's constantly playing the Observer, and while he never leaves the diner, he's constantly making notes, and he seems to know what's going on around the world, even though he doesn't appear to actually go anywhere.
Right.
And he's not like he's reading the paper or watching the television, so he's got no way of going on. The only sort of input he's got is what's happening in the outside world. It's through the feedback he receives from each of the people he's tasked with.
Uh-huh.
And again, with these tasks, they're so random, but the payoff and how it comes together is really where the charm of the series comes, such as the fact you've got Mrs. Tyler, she's like 80-odd, and she's been tasked with making a bomb. And I love the opening conversation it has, and she's like explaining how she found out how to make a bomb off the internet, and like relishing the fact it's this useful source of information, but at the same time apologizing for how long it's taken her because of her age. She can't manipulate the parts as quickly as mm-hmm. she wants to.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's with her, it's sort of this more moral sort of complex. In for the most part, she's like more than happy. She sees it as a worthy price to pay for getting her husband back. And other times we have tasks such as Melody, who's tasked with helping the shut-in.
Right.
And her task fails horribly, from what we can tell.
Yeah.
Although we do obviously see that it does come true, but it basically amounts to do good deeds and you'll be punished.
There's a very... Melody's story is one of my favorites because there's a very monkey's paw sort of feel to it. You know,
yes.
the whole thing where the family wishes for money and... Well, they get their money. They get their money because their son was killed in a war, and this is, you know, the payment for that. You know, his insurance or whatever from the military. I don't remember the exact story. But there's a very kind – and it's really, really a very much a sort of be careful what you wish for type thing. And watching the characters kind of evolve over the course of the story is just a fascinating – I keep coming back to this word fascinating, but I had never heard of this show before. About 3 or 4 years ago, I was just randomly looking up things to watch on Hulu, and this show was there, and I had no idea what it was, no idea what it's about, nothing like that, and I pretty much binge watched the entire season the entire series in an evening. I mean, I'm not kidding you. You can watch it all in about 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
But again, the thing I keep coming back to here is how, like I said, there's no action. When characters die, you don't see shootouts on screen. You don't hear gunshots or anything like that. You know, when you know, James kills Willem, you know, James comes in and says, yeah, I killed that guy that was, you know, that had abducted the little girl. You know, so it's really, I think, a masterclass in how to handle things through dialogue.
Yeah, it's a real... experimental sort of piece, and it was again here in the UK it was sold as that. It wasn't like advertised as a main sort of program. It was sort of like an experimental filler between that they showed between shows,
mm-hmm.
and it was again it was a late night sort of showing. But they would show these little snippets of advertising the booth at the end, in the same way that they would like advertise a web series, which obviously if you watch it on Hulu is. I'm guessing how it was originally intended, but here in the UK it was shown on FX as just as like a little mini TV series.
I don't even know that over here it got an airing on television. I think this was one of the first shows that was advertised as a Hulu original. Not that it was specifically made for Hulu like shows are now, but I remember this one and Misfits showed up on Hulu at about the same time as quote-unquote, you know, originals, even though obviously Misfits was made for, I think, Channel 4 in Britain.
Yeah.
I've
yet to watch it. I've heard bits and pieces about it, but I think because it was the idea of Chav superheroes, I found it harder to get into, in the same way that whenever you show like 18th century London and cobbled streets, I kind of feel the urge to roll my eyes, while audiences outside the UK are very much charmed by these things, or very exotic, in the same way that we find things such as The Wire and 24 and sort of American police procedural shows such as Law and Order.
Right.
More exotic and interesting to watch, even there, though it's pretty much just standard television, I guess, to an American audience for the most
part. Yeah. Those are the... I mean... American police procedurals on American television, they're really looked down upon. It's kind of almost like a lower form of television life.
Yeah.
And because they are such comfort food, really. There's not a whole lot to them. You can watch them in just about... You can watch any episode of... There's, you know, very few running arcs. There's very little... Particularly to, like, mid-90s and 2000s Law and Orders. There's very little in the way of, like, multi-episode arcs.
Well,
Misfits is interesting, though, in the fact... It's kind of like the anti-heroes.
Yeah.
It's at least the first two seasons are kind of interesting. I don't think that it's... I think a consistently quality, really good show, but it at least I was always engaged with what was going on, even when I tended to roll my eyes at some of the things that would happen. And it's got some absolutely cracking performances. The guy who plays Ramsay on Game of Thrones is on it as a completely, still creepy, but an entire 360 degrees away creepy.
Yeah, I feel it's often how things are presented, because they tried to do Law and Order in the UK, and the problem is, if you do it in the UK, is that when you see British police, and it's the bobby on the beat, and that, it's all very stuffy, and when you get into the courtrooms, it's stuffier still, because we've got barristers and judges and powdered wigs and all these things of the British legal system, whereas when we watch the American version... We've got, like, Benson and Stabler that are there in, like, the smart suits, and, you know, Stabler's there kicking ass and interrogating people with violence, and you get into the law things, and we've got, like, the sleazy lawyer there in his $1,000 suit, and the judge and stuff. And it feels very more streamlined, more modern. It doesn't feel so stuffy.
Right.
But, again, to an audience outside the UK, I think it may have that exotic appeal, because it's got that sort of sense of British traditionalism and protocol that we kind of like to carry across.
Yeah, it's... I never watched it. I had one friend who watched it basically because he was joking that this is basically where old Doctor Who actors come to die. Because at one point, Freema Agyeman and Peter Davison were both part of the regular cast, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Davison, who's basically, I guess in Britain, he's more of a sitcom star, and even was, like, before Doctor Who. But over here, we just, if we don't associate Peter Davison with Doctor Who, we associate him with, like, mysteries and, like, playing Campion and stuff like that.
I think with anyone who, for the most part, the main Doctors, they're always like, oh, he was on Doctor Who first, and then it's... Anything that he did didn't follow. Then Peter Davison, Sylvester McCoy, Tom Baker especially.
Right.
Those are the main ones. Sort of like some of the later ones, such as the actor who followed Peter Davison.
Colin Baker.
Again, he was more of a forgotten one, but I think that's more just to him having a weaker season. And it's really funny, because when they brought back three of the Doctors for the special they did, where they had Peter Davison, and they're going round and they're like reuniting with old Doctor Who actors, and there you got Peter Davison having this fantasy of like going in, like everyone's worshipping him, and he's like,
I love it when he goes up to Jenna Coleman, and Jenna Coleman in this vision, she says, "You were my mum's favorite doctor," and then he turns away, and then he turns back to her, and she says, "You were my favorite doctor."
And the fact you got Colin there, and he's sort of like getting excited because there's special features on the disc, which means more him.
Even more of me.
And it was so good, because I didn't really care for him as the Doctor, But I really loved him in that role when he's like standing on the ride on mower to try and get a better phone signal.
He's really there's a company in Britain, you may or may not already know this, for like the five people out there who are Doctor Who fans that haven't heard about Big Finish, there's a company in Britain that does basically a line of full cast audio plays, licensed by the BBC, starring actors from the original series, and the ones starring Colin Baker are he actually is generally considered the best doctor of that particular little section of Doctor Who, because they really kind of go back to how he wanted the doctor to be played, and the idea of a somewhat darker, more ruthless, more pragmatic, less idealistic doctor without going through with number one in audio, so you don't have all these horrendously tacky costumes distracting you. I mean, that's part of the problem with anything in that particular era of Doctor Who, is that when you've got to, when all your design has to compete with this husky maniac in, a jacket that, a frock coat that looks like somebody vomited out patchwork, when you've got to compete against that, you know, it's just, I mean, Doctor Who, 1985, 1986, watching it gives me a headache, not because of the stories, not because of the acting, but because the design is just so horrifically over the top.
Yeah.
So you can really, it's really afforded him the chance to put in subtler performances. And there's more attention being, you know, brought to the stories. You know, there was I think it was him actually that said that part of the problem with his tenure on Doctor Who was that the producer at the time was more interested in being photographed with celebrities than actually producing the show. And he unfortunately kind of got screwed in that era. I thought he would have made a terrific doctor on screen. It's just, everything behind the scenes just sucked.
Yeah. I'm still holding out for Richard E. Grant to properly played the Doctor. I know he's done audio plays. He did the sort of between seasons, between Sylvester McCoy's period and the official relaunch.
He was going to be, I remember this very well, the Scream of the Shelka. He was the official Eighth Doctor. Richard E. Grant was the official Eighth Doctor for about a month.
Yeah.
they started to put Scream of the Shelka online, and about a month after that, they announced a new TV show. And I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, and then we had Christopher Eccleston, who was like, oh, for Christ's
sake. I liked Christopher Eccleston. I have to say, Richard E. Grant, I think, has that certain sort of arrogance and smarminess that's perfect for playing the Doctor, though.
Yeah, I think he's perfect, and he's got that sort, he gives the sort of performance that Alan Cumming spent the best part of his life trying to imitate. Badly.
I don't hate Alan Cumming. He's done a few roles that I really liked him in. I can't actually bring any to mind now. He has kind of turned into a camp parody of himself.
He's a jackass.
Oh, I'm sure he is. Here at TV Good Sleep Bad, your source for opinions on Alan Cummings. He's a jackass. No, I'm sure he is. Richard E. Grant just, I remember even like the first time I saw him in things back in like the mid 80s, it's just like, that guy is like John Pertwee come back to life. With just that arrogance.
But, before the end, I mean, do we have anything that we haven't sort of discussed in this one?
This is one of those where I actually think we got more conversation out of it than I thought we were going to, because that it isn't complex in its own way. It's, you know, it like I said, it's something that's almost deceptively simple. It's, you know, two, maybe three actors, two sets, no action. And really very experimental, really shows you what you can do, push the envelope. I don't think it really would have lasted a third season. And I know Xander Berkeley basically said, I didn't want to do any more. I think we all thought it had run its course.
Yeah. It's an experiment. That's what it basically just an experimental piece that lives and dies on its performances. And certainly with the first season, it's mainly no-name actors. I mean, Xander Berkeley, I mean, as we said already, I mean, it's hard enough to place who Xander Berkeley is without obviously seeing a picture of him. But
Sarah Clark is probably about the closest thing you have in a named actor or actress in the first season. Dayton Callie from Deadwood and Sons of Anarchy shows up in the second season. God, I can't remember what his character's name. I can't remember his character's name on Deadwood. He was a guy that always hung around with Calamity Jane. But yeah, I mean, this is basically kind of like a character actor showcase.
I personally would recommend checking out. As you said, it's only 5 episodes. It runs really at a brisk pace.
It does. It doesn't feel like, you know, you're spending 90 minutes watching it.
I would recommend watching before you like decide whether you're going to watch it or not. I mean, it's 5 episodes, so if you give up around episode 2, I think that's your choice, but really watch the first 2 episodes before you decide to have any opinion on it, because it's only when the second episode has finished that you can start to see how it's all coming together. At the start, it seems a bit sporadic.
Right.
You can't see how it's going to tie together. But by the season, episode 2, you can start to see how characters are starting to interlink, and they don't realize that he's sort of playing this off.
Right.
As in the case of the nun, Sister Carmel. She doesn't know that she's being set up with the painter, Simon.
Right.
Who's, I mean, he's this artist, and he basically doesn't feel, though he's producing anything of note, and he's basically tasked with having a child, and the man says, you can ignore the child. Mm-hmm. It's about having the child, and he ends up being involved with Sister Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
And through it, she's able to hear God again, and he finds inspiration for his painting.
Right.
And it's a random thing, but, you know, it's just one of the more simpler links that we have here. But
yeah.
It's a show that's definitely worth checking out. I, like yourself, I'm glad it didn't go a third season.
Right.
Each season's self-contained, but I feel that within those 2 seasons, we explore the idea as much as we could.
Yeah. But it's definitely, I think, worth... It's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah.
So... 2 thumbs up to Booth at the End.
That's cool. That brings us to the end of another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. Our next episode, we are doing our Christmas special, which we are going to be spending with those foul-mouthed children of South Park.
Yep.
Like, which episode have you chosen? Because I think we're just going to end up covering all of the Christmas specials, but...
Specifically, I've picked the first season Christmas episode. I'm not talking about the 2 Christmas, quote-unquote, video Christmas cards. I'm talking about what, to me, was probably the last of what we'd call in America the last water cooler moment of American television, where everybody you knew would come up to you and say, did you see that show South Park? Can they do that? Talking about an episode called Mr. Hanky the Christmas Poo.
For myself, I've decided to go for an episode which really showed at this point when it was released just how little the creators of South Park cared about being censored, as they gave us probably one of the most shocking alternate Christmas episodes ever, and that's the Woodland Critter Christmas, which features Satanists worshipping forest animals, as well as many other bad things. Which we will go into on that episode.
I have to say, this is the thing. It's like the point at which you realize that they no longer cared about the censors. I honestly have to say, I couldn't even imagine. In 90, I think it was 97 or 98 when I first saw the Christmas episode. I can't imagine. It's like, I don't even. I can't. It was like I was like a teenage girl. I can't even. Figure out where the hell they could possibly go from there. I mean, South Park's been on the air for 20 years, I could never have predicted that they wouldn't have somehow run out. But, yep, South Park Christmas, kids.
And, this was an episode that I got brought into because the Nostalgia Critic showed the clip and it was like, oh, Joyful Animals with little cliche names. And I thought, oh, wow, they're going to do like a foul-mouthed version of Disney. And yeah, I was wrong. And I watched this badly with my wife on the computer beside me. And I was like, had my head between my hands going, what the hell am I watching? Needless to say, she wasn't impressed. Reasons why we will go into on our next episode.
So, thank you very much for listening. We will see... Well, I guess you won't see us again because we're in the audio realm. But we will be back in 30 days. Until then, I'm Lackey from the Nightmare Gallery.
And I'm Owen Jones of from the Depths of DVD Hell.
And we would like to invite you to continue to keep it strange. Or... if you can't keep it strange, at least keep it slightly weird. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.